With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Palm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green, really, just a trisket, not a people biscuit. Take my word. It's been said you can't handle the truth, but that ain't so. How do I know?
The year was 1985. I was a sixth grader at Granada Middle School in Whittier, California. My friend and tastemaker Matt Russell handed me an oversized black and white comic book about turtles. But hold on, these turtles were also ninjas. And I should also mention that they were, of course, mutants as well. And when we went to class, hold on, there's more. They were teenagers, like me. But still, there was something else. They were funny, and the world that they lived in was dark and violent, bloody, really. And that, of course, appealed to a young me, and I became obsessed. I bought all the issues, I drew the turtles everywhere I could, as you will hear in this interview, and even went so far as to track down their creators, Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, at the then still relatively young San Diego Comic-Con. I got them to sign my original copies of the comics. I still have them to this day. I thought I was into something special and something that belonged to a small group of collectors that were in the know. But I was really just a part of a growing and enormous group of people that would eventually become the Turtle Maniacs. So when Raphael, Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Donatello became mass market celebrities, I had my first ever hard knock experience in realizing your heroes could be sellouts. How could they take my cool black and white reptilian Avengers of the Night and turn them into animated Technicolor kids' toys? I mean, they took something called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and made them child's play. You can't just take something that's a teenager and a mutant and a ninja and a turtle and not take it seriously. But of course I was wrong. And now I know that everyone should experience turtle power. Why was I so selfish? Well, I don't know. I was 12. But I'm not anymore, and I'm not selfish anymore, and I'm glad to celebrate the first and best Ninja Turtle film here today. Amen. Well, I'm Matt Gourley, host of I Was There Too, the show where I talk to people present in the most interesting scenes of cinema and stuff. Today, Josh Pice is my guest. He played Raphael in the first Ninja Turtles movies, and among many other things can also be seen in Dennis Leary's new show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Now let's connect him to last episode's guest. Josh Molina to Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men. Tom Cruise to Jerry O'Connell in Jerry Maguire. Jerry O'Connell to Corey Feldman in Stand By Me. Corey Feldman to Josh Pice in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There. Today's episode is a real corker. And make sure, God damn it, make sure to stay tuned after the interview for another installment of one of the most important segments history has ever known. Okay, here we go.
The film, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The year, 1990. The role, Raphael. The actor, Josh Pice.
So, Josh Pice, I feel like I need to reveal my credentials to you in that not only was I a huge Ninja Turtles fan when I was younger, Raphael was my guy, so much so that I carved him into the door of my bedroom here as pictured. I know that there's no color headband.
That's a good carving.
Thank you. I had some issues I had to work out on door fixtures, but it is confirmed in the comments there that that is Raphael, so you're kind of a hero of mine in many ways.
Well,
thank you for being here.
Sure.
So you're Raphael, who's, you know, you're the bad boy, you're the brooder, the tough guy. What do you think got you that role as opposed to one of the other turtles?
Well, I grew up in the East Village in New York City.
You had a bit of a chip on your shoulder already?
Kind of. I mean, it was just a very tough neighborhood. Uh-huh. And I had to, you know, being kind of a scrawny kid, had to make myself at times walk bigger and tougher than I actually was so that I wouldn't get perpetually mugged. And really, until I was 13, I got mugged all the time.
You're kidding.
Yeah, until I actually started doing martial arts. And then nobody ever bothered me, and I never used martial arts, but that ended that.
Why? Because you just carried yourself in a way that
someone wouldn't. I carried myself differently. Prior to that, I must have just been, you know, hey, mug me. Yeah, I just had it increased my awareness of my environment. We would spar in the dark, so it really trained all of us to become really aware of our environment. And I think just having that awareness, that's all I can assume, having that awareness, you know, I could feel when people were around me.
Did you ever have any particularly violent muggings, or were they just your run-of-the-mill?
No, they were. A lot of it was I went to this hippie school called the Little Red Schoolhouse, and there was the mafia kids, and they went to Our Lady of Pompeii.
Oh, my God.
Which
These
was,
names.
Like, right down the street. And they would just kind of terrorize us. And it wasn't like, it never got really bloody, but it was, they would kind of, you know, circle us and kind of play catch with us, like push us back and forth.
That's horrible.
Yeah. It was just kids terrorizing each other.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, at times it was absolutely terrifying. And other times it was like, okay, you know, I know this will be over in about 12 minutes. You know, they'll get bored.
Well, this goes a long way.
What if I started weeping right now and had like a total meltdown?
There's something about that if the guy that played Raphael just starts weeping.
Right.
I think I would be open to that.
Okay.
I have to tell you.
I'll be open to all my emotions.
Please, I don't consider myself the Barbara Walters of podcasts, but if you wish to cry, I'm ready to take on that mantle.
Let me just be open to it.
Please.
And
please, you know, won't force it.
Okay.
But that does go a long way in answering one of my next questions about why you are, if I'm correct, the only one of the turtles that's in the suit and does the voice.
Right.
So you have the martial arts skills and also a bit of the experience of someone living in New York like Raphael.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we rehearsed the movie like a play for about 3 weeks in North Carolina. And during that process, we each had somebody that operated our faces. And it was a very important relationship, and we really took it seriously. And the puppeteer, in a sense, that controlled the face really wanted to capture my face.
Oh, wow.
And to really match this physicality that I had created.
And this is someone from the Henson Company,
yeah,
right?
Someone from the Henson Company. And I developed a physicality and a voice that was so connected to the body that when it came time to, you know, put it all together, they just couldn't imagine anybody else doing the voice.
That's saying something, because it didn't happen for the other three guys, not to take anything away from them, but that's saying something. Now you can cry. So what's the audition process like for a Ninja Turtle? You've done so much other work, much of which we'll talk about in a minute, but that must have been different than anything you'd done, right?
My agent called and said, you have an audition for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Were you familiar with
that? No, not at all. And I had to literally have him say it three times because my mind couldn't grasp
Why
those four
it?
Words
Why
together.
Why would it? Yeah.
And then, you know, he said it's to be a turtle. And just, I was like, okay.
Are you thinking at any point, like you know, most people that start out in acting in elementary school play a tooth or a tree or a turtle, and here you are auditioning for a turtle. You're just,
yeah,
whatever the world takes you.
Yeah. I mean, part of me was like, you know, what's happened to me? And another part of me was like, I'm just starting out. I'll do anything.
Of course, yeah.
And I read the script and I loved it. And I loved the character. And I created just a way that he moved. Like I said, as a kid and a lot of people in growing up in tough neighborhoods, like they develop walks to develop a stature so that nobody will mess with them. And that combined, I played with that combined with how turtles, their hands move out to the side.
Oh, yeah.
And then I kind of put it all together and developed a strut and just really created a physicality for the character as I do for most of the things that I do. And I threw in a couple flying kicks and it worked.
How long did it take you to acclimate to the suit in terms of conveying your physicality? Because I would imagine that's different with no suit, and then you take on the burden of that weight. You've got to, what, heighten it a little bit, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, the suit weighed 70 pounds.
Jeez.
And it was quite a process to get it on. And the last part that would go on was the head, and then they would glue the head on.
And I read a little bit about this. This is a tough experience for you. Right?
At times, it was really tough. I'd never experienced claustrophobia before, but you're completely sealed in. It's hard to breathe, and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And you have very limited vision. And when we were shooting, it was fine because that intensity of being in the suit, like it just helped me with the performance. In terms of moving, it just, you know, also I would look at myself when I was in the suit and just the muscles and just allowed all that to affect how I moved. And when we were shooting, it was awesome. When we stopped, you know, between takes and things would break down because at that time it was cutting edge technology and things were breaking down all the time. And we'd be in these suits for hours with nothing, you know, while something's going wrong.
Well, that begs the bigger question. What about bathroom breaks? Without you just had to deal with it?
I mean, we'd lose 5 pounds from morning to lunch every day.
Just from sweating.
And from sweating. We would just drain as much as we could before getting in and just knowing that we couldn't get out.
And so if your vision is limited, how did that affect? You had some pretty precision fight scenes. And are you doing most all of the stunts in the fight?
I'm doing the less impressive stuff, like probably going into the fight, some of the basic stuff, but anything where there was, flips and that kind of stuff, they had stunt guys to do the real up in the air, all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But we trained for 4 months before shooting.
All four of you together?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, three of us. One guy was already in London.
Oh, okay.
He came from London.
And so did you have any expectations when this thing came out? Were you by then pretty familiar with the franchise and understood that there was a big following? Or was it a surprise to you that this was such a, I don't know,
I had hit? People kept saying, this is really going to be something. And I remember going to the premiere and watching the movie, and it was really in the first 5 minutes I had the sense that this was a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. From the people that I talked to that were fans of the Turtles all throughout their, I don't know, their long life, this is the movie everybody seems to go back to because they've done, I don't know, two or three reboots and cartoons and CG versions. And
right.
Yeah, this seems to be the one that resonates with people.
Why is that?
I guess because you're the original, the tried and true, you know? I don't know, the benchmark that every Raphael's got to live up to at this point. You carry that with you.
Right.
So I want to ask you specifically about some of the acting when you're in the suit. So you have this moment when Splinter is kidnapped, and you especially take it pretty hard, and you do this big screaming moment. It's an emotional moment.
Right.
In a normal scene where you're not wearing a costume, we have to see every intricacy of your face. How much of that is still like really an acting moment for you that you have to prepare? Or, I mean, I imagine some people would sort of phone that in. I don't know. How did that work for you?
I mean, I took it just as seriously. I attempted to commit as fully as I possibly could with everything. I really don't think you can phone it in if it's going to resonate, especially because people read actors consciously or unconsciously based on how their bodies move and the energy that they're emitting, and you can't fake that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't phone it in.
That's a testament to you though, because that comes across in you're wearing a 70-pound suit. That's something. You're a unique guest for this podcast because you not only play Raphael in the suit, but you're also the voice, but you also appear in the film as yourself, as the man in the cab, right?
I do.
Yeah, this is like a triple threat in a way.
Yeah, that was super fun. We had, we shot me kind of coming and rolling over the cab. And
that's right, yeah, you're in a scene with yourself.
I'm in a scene with myself, yeah.
But so you're doing your own coverage.
It was shot on different days. And actually in different locations. Because the interior stuff inside the cab was just in a cab. I believe we were in a studio and just shooting it, you know, right there.
So most of your shoot was in North Carolina, but you did what, a couple of
establishing
shots? We
did about a week in New York.
Uh-huh.
We shot the things in Central Park, the scene with Casey Jones, me coming out of a movie theater, me at City Hall.
Oh, yeah. Most of your scenes where you're wearing your flasher garb.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
How was it working with Elias Koteas?
It was great.
He seems like an intense and fun guy.
Super, super intense, super playful, but, first intense. And he was super, I've met him, our paths have crossed over the years. But somehow at that point, he was taking this super seriously.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Going method? Is that what you're saying?
I would say so, yeah.
So interesting. Method is Casey Jones in the Ninja Turtles movie. I love this kind of thing where these type of things cross over.
Yeah.
Any circumstances where he was just in character between takes and he answered back as Casey Jones, or is it that
it was
deep?
All the turtles, we were all became good buddies because we were just like going through like weird boot camp together.
Yeah.
And all of us are, in essence, goofballs. And so we would, it was kind of our survival technique, just being in these suits, just to have a good time as much as possible and try to make each other laugh. And sometimes we would attempt to spill that over to him, and it just, there was no bounce back,
That's a little surprising because his character is a bit of a wise ass,
yeah. But
he was in fighter mode,
yeah. He was in it.
Let's talk a bit more about the shoot. How was the director, Steve Barron?
Steve Barron was awesome.
He's directed a couple of my favorite music videos, Money for Nothing by Dire Straits and Take on Me by A-ha. He's kind of made a career for himself of doing interesting, different visual
things.
And
then he did the Coneheads movie.
That's right, yeah.
He was just awesome, just super, super great guy. He was let go at some point towards the end
of this film.
Yeah.
Oh.
Little inside.
Oh yeah. Is this an eye? Was there too exclusive?
Yeah.
Did you just do a panther growl?
He didn't get. They kind of took the picture away from him at the very end.
So the editing might not be his version.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
But he created such a great visual world, and he did an amazing job.
Did you get the sense that the film would be different if it was left in his control till the end, or?
I think some people got were a little bit concerned about the darkness of the film.
Right.
But that really is what made it.
That's what the comics were, and that's how I originally got into it, because they were very violent and very dark. In fact, I think I pulled out of the Turtles franchise around the time it started getting very childlike.
Right.
Yeah, but I could see
And I think some people got scared that it was going to be too – it would scare kids. But somehow it there was a perfect balance of having a darkness, but also there was a lightness in the characters at the same time, and it made it feel safe and that you were entering another world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of why – so many people responded to it.
It's interesting that the credited editor, or at least one of them, is Sally Hankey. It was her first film, and she was known for working on all of Quentin Tarantino's films. So I wonder how much of that carries through the whole process. I could see some similarities in his films
for
in this
sure.
one.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're just going to take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about a lot of your other projects.
Awesome.
Great. I'm back with Josh Pice, who played Raphael in the Ninja Turtles. You also have a training institution called Committed Impulse. Is that correct?
I do, yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
I went to a very traditional acting school, and it was
The Little Red House?
That was pre... Actually, the Little Red Schoolhouse is closer to Committed Impulse than my actual...
Oh, now I'm curious.
My actor training in college was very... It made a lot of sense. It was very intellectual, and I was exposed to somebody who had just come back from working with this wild dude named Jerzy Grotowski.
Oh, Jerzy Grotowski. I read those books for my grad thesis.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, now here we go.
And so, you know, this woman came back, and she had just come back from training with him, and she was at our at my college, and exposed us to this work, which was very physical, very just completely out of your head, completely spontaneous, completely impulsive work. And it just resonated for me. And so I went on a journey after college to train and seek out people, directors from really all different parts of the world that were training actors in a physical non-psychological way.
You literally traveled around the world?
I traveled around, and I sought out people that, as they would come to the United States, like Tadashi Suzuki. I worked with the Avant-Garde Theater of Tokyo, and just sought out people because I really wanted to find a way to be spontaneous. Like, I wanted to...
It's the hardest thing to do, right?
Yeah. And so I was just on a real mission because... I just felt if I wasn't being spontaneous when I was creating, it was just bullshit. And I then was part of a theater company called Circle Rep in New York City. And they said, why don't I start directing and why don't I start training people in all this work that I've been doing? And I thought, okay, you know, I'll give that a shot. So for over a period of a year, I trained these actors. We created these theater pieces. And periodically, the deal was that we would show the process, and people would come and just watch these exercises that I had created. And NYU asked me to do it, and then I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And I've been doing it, you know, most of my life.
Is it just a different process from theater to film? Because
no,
the different. So it's the same.
Yeah, it's. I mean, part of Committed Impulse is to, the initial part is to get people to a place of pure impulse in their body, and then to convert that into whatever material they're working on, and to give people tools to basically alter their physicality, which then alters their imagination and then allows them to create in the present moment.
I want to ask you about a few of the things that you've done and what it was like to work on some of these kind of iconic shows and films. So you were on The Sopranos, a favorite of mine.
Well, I mean, it was an episode. Steve Buscemi directed it, and I played Junior's lawyer. And just to be on that set was just amazing.
Yeah, what's the atmosphere like there?
It's just focused, playful. It felt like there was time to explore, but nothing. There was no wasted time. And you know, just being at the table read, and Gandolfini's like sitting across me with, he had like a big styrofoam thing of ziti. And
seriously,
and he's just like, you know, eating ziti, you know, all during.
I'm just
the
convinced
read-through.
He's Tony Soprano.
Yeah,
or was.
Yeah, and it was just a very focused, creative, playful, no waste. Some shows you can work on, and it just feels like everybody's just standing around, and you have no idea what's getting done, if anything. And then after about 10 minutes, somebody goes, "Okay, let's get back to it." And you have everybody's just been standing around.
Was David Chase pretty hands on?
Well, Buscemi was really running it. I mean, David so Chase, yeah.
They gave him control.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
This was in the later season, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you knew the reputation of this show. Was there any kind of nerves you had to battle?
Yeah. I mean, it was such a, it was a show that I really wanted to be a part of.
Yeah.
I'd worked on most of the shows that shoot in New York, and, but it was, I mean, this was just one of my favorite shows, and it meant, I mean, it. I had to just keep, you know, coming back to just doing the work, because if I, you know,
if you got too,
if I got into like,
it, yeah.
I can't believe I'm on The Sopranos, you know, like it would just, you know, destroy, you know,
absolutely,
what I was doing. You know, once we got shooting, like everybody was just right there, you know, and it was just felt very immediate, which is something that I'm always, you know, I feel like
it's the backbone of your work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. If it's immediate and it's unfolding and each take is somewhat different and you're kind of directed, let's try it a little bit this way and that way. And it just felt like we were all in this together. I didn't feel at all like I was a visitor. Like once we started shooting, it was just like we're all creating this together.
You worked on a film by another auteur, Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Again, I mean, just to work with him.
You've had some real
yeah.
jobs.
And also to work with Philip Seymour Hoffman
right.
was outstanding. Fortunately, I had met him a couple times prior, so it wasn't. And he was just an awesome, great guy, just right there, and no pretense at all. So even though, you know, on some level I couldn't help but put him up on a pedestal,
sure.
I also knew that he was very right there kind of guy, and
that seems like the type of pedestal where his work would inform yours and fuel it rather than intimidate you.
Absolutely.
And he seems generous. I've never had any contact with him, but he
yeah.
seems that way.
And Charlie Kaufman, he almost directed with this energy. He has like this creative, chaotic energy in him.
That you can't see right now, but Josh is
just
gesticulating like crazy.
And, yeah. I mean, if you could see inside his skull, it would probably just, the atoms would be like just in a high velocity speed. But on outside, he's more still, but somehow he, with very few words, he communicates a lot, and it was an awesome experience.
Hmm. Now, you've got some very interesting projects coming up. First of all, the TV show Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll with Dennis Leary. You've worked with him before, right?
Yeah, a couple times.
Have quite a rapport at this point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote this for me.
Is this all because you'd worked together before, or did you know him prior?
No, we just knew each other from working and really didn't have any contact in between.
The last thing I want to ask you about is the film you have coming out called I Saw the Light, which is the biopic of Hank Williams. I'm a big Hank Williams fan.
Oh, yeah.
So you play Dor Sherry, the producer and director.
Yeah, producer, yeah, MGM, he was head of MGM.
I wasn't aware of how they cross paths. Can you spoil it or?
Well, it's basically...
Tom Hiddleston is playing Hank Williams, which seems like great casting to me.
He's amazing in this, and his singing.
He's actually singing. Really.
Yeah,
he really
went for it, and it's masterful.
When does this come out?
I don't know exactly. I don't think the date's been set. You're looking it up.
I am.
And now he's looking it up.
We'll cut all this out. Or maybe we won't if we continue to talk like this. This might be this may be the brunt of the voice.
This might be the opening trailer for the whole podcast.
All it says is I saw the light 2015. So sometime this year.
Don't miss it. We should have talked like this
the whole time. We really, really.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about what happened.
Why don't you tell a story?
Okay. If I may.
Please.
So basically, Hank Williams is a superstar.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, and I play a big, big, big Hollywood, the guy that runs MGM, Dor Sherry. And I don't know if I can do it anymore.
It's all right.
But basically... I try to bring him into the movie business, and he's got a lot of attitude, and I'm not used to people having a lot of attitude. And
did that happen? Did he go?
Yeah, it did happen. Yeah,
just briefly. It must
just
have because he didn't live long.
Just briefly.
Did he?
No,
back of a Cadillac.
Hey, right? Boom.
I cannot wait for that movie.
Yeah, it's gonna be a good one.
I will be looking for you in it.
Okay.
The listeners can find you at Josh Pais on Twitter, right? JOSHPAIS.
Yeah.
Anywhere else that you'd like them to find
Instagram,
you?
Instagram.
Instagram, you do it all.
Yeah, I do some pictures.
You do. Yeah. All right.
If you want to see my dog.
I post a lot of my cat pictures on Instagram as well.
So. I do believe I have the cutest dog ever.
I believe I have the cutest cat ever, and I'm sure we're the first to ever think this about our stupid
pets. I'm...
you're sure?
Like, I literally cannot walk down the street without people stopping.
Let's talk like this for just a little bit longer while we take a look.
Take out your phones, pull up your pictures.
All right. Josh, it's just your name on Instagram, right?
Josh Pais.
There it is. Let's see. Well, the first thing I'm seeing is a picture of
my penis.
What seems to be a naked woman in the streets of New York with
her naked woman.
Buttocks painted NY.
See, that's enough to get people to look.
Come for the dog, but stay for the body painting. Oh, look at this. Whoa. You're not kidding.
Right?
It's like it's a Welsh corgi wearing a fur coat.
Yeah. He's an Australian shepherd.
Kuma?
Kuma, yeah.
What's the meaning of that name?
Kuma means bear in Japanese,
and
he looks like a bear, right? He looks like a teddy bear.
Yeah,
he looks like an animated character.
He really,
like
really
people,
does.
The other day, I was, I'm most of the time in New York, but I'm more and more in L.A., and this car came around the corner, and it was like, I saw the whole thing in slow motion. It was like this beautiful, voluptuous blonde, and she kind of, swayed her head, and her hair went to the side, and she saw Kuma. Like, I thought maybe, she didn't see me at all. But she saw Kuma and just, like, was like, she almost licked her lips. Like, and she was, it was just like a beautiful, slow,
What do you think about that?
Wow. Oh, my God.
That's Margot the fat guy.
Wow.
She's
Margot?
Huge. Yeah, Margot. We gave her the most pretentious name.
Did you say the fat guy?
The fat. She's a girl. It's a long story.
Okay.
It's a long, I've always called cats fat guys, I think, because I had a fat boy when I was a kid. Cat. Anyway,
that's
troubling.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Wow, you have 339 likes.
Margo has 339 likes.
Right.
Yeah. She's a looker. You know what? Congratulations to us for our absolutely the best looking cat and dog ever.
Yeah.
Josh Pais, thank you so much for joining me today. It was great to talk to you. Jazz. My thanks to Josh Peiss, and you can find out more about his acting training at committedimpulse.com. I'd also like to thank Lacey Lovett and Steve Snowy for connecting me to Josh. It's people like that out there doing the Lord's work that makes this show possible. Thank you. Now, on to something special and culturally important. Here's a little movie trivia you probably haven't heard. In 2002, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, undisputably the best of the six Star Wars films, was released. But Natalie Portman almost didn't reprise her role as Padme. Due to a contract negotiation that went south, Lucas went as far as casting and shooting with another actress. Some people say it was a bluff, some people say it was an insurance policy, but either way it worked, and eventually Natalie Portman returned to the film. But that footage exists with the previous actress, and it's none other than past I Was There Too guest, Margot the Fat Guy. Now that seems ridiculous, and also like a premise for this podcast, but it's absolutely true. We're going to talk to Margot a little bit about how this happened, but first, let's take a listen to the never-before-released scene. This is between Margot, who is playing Padme, and Hayden Christensen as Anakin Skywalker. They've been captured by the Geonosians and are bound on a chariot about to enter an arena of death when they pledge their love for each other in a very tender moment.
Don't be afraid. Decided not to fall in love. That we would be forced to live a lie. And that it would destroy our lives.
Margot the Fat Guy, I want to thank you for taking the time to come back on I Was Their Mew. And what are you up to these days? That fat, huh? How are things with your owners? Because I know last time you weren't exactly treating us well. Oh, a horrible fat monster? So stupid, you need four legs to be the dumbest thing on two legs? But we love you all the same? I see. All right, look, I just want to get to it. Now, I didn't even know you were in this film. What was that experience like? As a Gungan? Oh, you're talking about midichlorians. Yeah, I was sad they dropped that too. Now, speaking of franchise films, and this is apparently true, you jumped on the screen door of a high-up second-story window and rode it down to the ground like Indiana Jones did that life raft in Temple of Doom. Is that right? And you were okay? Because you're a huge ball of absolute padding. I see. Well, Margot, I want to thank you for talking to me again today, like you do every morning at 5 a.m. when you walk on my face. I love you.
I was there, Mew.
That's it for I Was There Too. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Matt Gourley. Please give this podcast a review on iTunes. That helps keeps us bumps up in the charts. Add a little plural stroke there. Also, email me if you can connect me to a great guest for the show at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. And also, email me with your listener questions. I'm probably going to do an answer some questions segment sometime soon for this podcast. So if you want to know anything about how this show works or what it's like or who I am wearing... please email me as well at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Dire Straits.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.